If you wake up and your heart rate is 5 or 6 beats higher, you're either getting ill or you're really, really stressed. And again, this is learning and listening to your body. If you're really stressed and you've got like a 10K run and you wake up and you go, I can't do 10K, that's fine. Listen to your body. Just do a 4K run.
Are you dreaming of going for a run and enjoying it? Or how about competing in a triathlon but are prone to discomfort and injury? That's what today's episode is all about. Welcome to the 40th episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast. My name is Nikki Robertson, and today I chat with sports kinesiologist, coach, and author Mike Roscoe about the mind game involved in pushing your physical boundaries. Mike explains how anyone with the right training can perform like a pro. There is a science to becoming an athlete, whether you want to run a marathon, compete in a triathlon, or simply do a 5K the right way. You can find Mike on Instagram, Facebook, and his website, and all these links can be found in the show notes.
The sport really started when I was 15 years old, and actually came out of coming from having really, really bad childhood asthma, not being able to run like more than 20 meters without having an attack, and having a school teacher that kind of guided me through and literally got me to do my first run ever, which was probably 50 meters. That built up, and you know, the fitter you get, the stronger you get, the more in control of your disease you get. And that started a lifelong love of running. So that was at 15, that's almost 40 years ago. So that's a lot of running. Mm-hmm. So running has kind of been the go-to from the beginning. I think looking after people was back in the day in South Africa, you had to go to the army. And in my world, it was, I managed to do a few paramedics courses because I wanted to avoid having to kind of shoot people. And I managed to get into the medics, South African Medical Services, ended up at One Mill, got as highly qualified as you could get as a paramedic there, and got national colors as a paramedic. And that's where I really started to learn. I'd studied before that maths and physics, but I'd realized there that I wanted to deal with people. And so it's a very long kind of convoluted story. I've never gone from A to B. I've kind of always fitted a number of letters in between, but then ended up studying kinesiology and soft tissue release and coaching science. And what I do is kind of merging all of those, and then merging, you know, one of the best ways to learn about a running injury is to get injured yourself.
Absolutely.
You know, that's first-hand knowledge. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's the long, long road that I've taken to get there.
And you're a triathlete yourself.
Yeah.
And you coach other people wanting to become triathletes or wanting to run marathons.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So what I think, let's start here. I mean, as you said, you started doing athletics, you started running from a very young age.
Yeah.
And most people, not most, but a lot of people only really start getting interested in exercising because they're overweight, or they have to start getting fit, or they've got some aches and pains, and it's just a really good idea to start, you know, it dawns on them that maybe they should get moving.
Yeah.
But they don't have that muscle memory or that endurance that's been built up through their childhood over their teenage years.
Yes.
And then they just slap on some shoes and hit the road and wonder why they feel like death.
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, I was guilty of the same thing. I was brought up in a family. I mean, I did plenty of sport, but I was never a runner. But I come from a family of runners. And I thought, well, you just go run. And
yes,
that's not true.
No.
That's just not true. So what tips and advice can you give to the average South African out there who goes, well, I started running during lockdown, but I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
It's not just a matter of, you know, heading the road and hoping for the best. Where do we start?
So that's an awesome question. Number one is equipment. Get into the right pair of running shoes. As a runner, as a cyclist, make sure that you're on a bike that's the right size for you, that is set up for you. Mm. Because if you go wrong there, if you're in the wrong pair of shoes, your shoes are the interface between you and the ground. If you're in the wrong pair of shoes, something's going to go wrong, foot-wise, calf-wise, knee, hip, low, back, even into the shoulder, the whole kinetic chain. If you're on the wrong size bike, or you're on the correct bike, but it's not properly set up, they're going to be aches and pains. And the danger with that is that almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I didn't run before because I thought it would hurt, and now I've started to run and I know it hurts, therefore I'm going to go, I'm just going to stop this. So for me, equipment would be number one, and I think that's where I kind of differ from, let's say, chiro or physio, in that I think I understand the equipment better than most. I understand running shoes. I study them. I've got people every day on the treadmill filming them. I know what a Adi Zero does versus a Nike this versus a Asics Nimbus shoe. I've got a feel for that, and then spent a lot of time on bike setups. Sometimes the difference between a lower back injury is literally 2 or 3 degrees of change on one or two of the bike settings. So get that right. The second thing is that you don't want to rush this. This is a long-term commitment. So, you know, for someone to go, I want to start running and I want to get my first park run done next weekend, I would kind of go, listen, why not? Let's do this over 12 weeks. And, you know, during lockdown, I wrote a program on how to literally go from being a walker through to running 5Ks over 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's free, and a whole bunch of people got onto that. And the feedback has been amazing. And it literally started with people walking a little bit, and then they threw in little runs. Because the whole of the human body is about tissue adaptation.
Yes.
And until the tissues have strengthened, you're going to break down. I think the second thing is, as much as what I love all the gadgets, and a good heart rate monitor watch is I think is critical, but the problem is that they come with GPSs, and you then link that to your Polar or your Garmin or whatever app, and then the next moment you're on Strava, and so suddenly there it says that you've just run your quickest 5 kilometer split this year. Mm-hmm. And the next day you go out and you decide, I'm going to do the same route, but I'm going to take 2 more seconds off.
I'm guilty of that. And yeah. Man, what a mistake.
Exactly. Mm. And so all that you end up doing is running faster and faster, and you are going to strain yourself. You're going to put yourself under pressure because you're going to wake up in the morning with a knot in your stomach, and you're going about the training in the worst possible way. So all the athletes that we get on, in order to build base, a large aerobic base and tissue strength, we get going on very, very low heart rate training. And it means that for a lot of them, they end up walking hills for a while. Mm. And walking up a hill is a thing of taming your ego, because you're going to hear a runner coming up behind you, and that competitive thing comes in, and the next minute you're trying to outrun them, and 3 weeks later you're down with an injury.
And you hate the run because it becomes progressively more uncomfortable.
Yeah. Mm. So a whole bunch of runners that have joined up with me, or triathletes, especially running, because running places unique stresses on a body, kind of get into the low heart rate thing, and they'll then get back to me and they'll go, you know what, it's taken me a while, but yesterday I did a 15K run and I got back and I wasn't tired.
Yes.
And if the weather's a little bit cooler, you know, like a winter, I mean, we've got athletes that get back after a 15K run and they've hardly sweated, and they get back and their bodies are in such a happy place. Mm. We live in a very stressful world. The whole thing of overstimulating your sympathetic nervous system. And I know the language sounds weird because sympathetic links up with the word sympathy, so you think that's the kind nervous system. Mm-hmm. Sympathetic is fight or flight. And so you're forever trying to run away from a runner, you're trying to catch another runner, and then you get back and you open your emails and you've got a day of fighting ahead of you. So your entire life is a fight at work, and then you start fighting on the run, and 3 weeks later you go, running's for the birds.
Mm.
And the runner that can slow down, get their heart rate down, get into a zen, into like a flow state, and from that flow state begin to enjoy the run. From that flow state, you've got time to appreciate nature.
Mm.
I know on my routes where the lurys live, and lurys are my favorite birds. I think they're, you know, that little crest on the top of the head, they're clumsy birds, they've got that amazing call. I sometimes run past, so if you ever see someone trying to sound like a lury, it's potentially me.
Yes.
And the lurys respond to you, they kind of talk back, and for me, that, and seeing clouds, seeing the change of season, you know, from from winter, the harshness of winter, the heat of summer, the beauty of spring, all of those things, sunlight, the cold, all of those things, rain, that just brings me alive.
And that is the flow state you're talking about.
That's flow state.
It's getting out of your body and integrating it with what's going on around you.
Yes.
And you forget about, you don't feel pain. You actually love the moment, you're in the moment.
And your brain wants that, and your brain needs that. Mm. It needs to find your body again, because we've forgotten about our bodies. Mm. We've forgotten about our feet and our calves and our knees and heels. You know, people say to me, but I stopped running in winter, and I'm horrified. Mm. You know, why would you do that? 500,000 years ago, you faced winter from your cave.
You know, we come up with so many excuses, and you know, and we believe them. I think we're all guilty. It's too hot, it's too cold, it's too wet, it's too dry, there's too much crime, it's just, you know, too early in the day, too late in the day. But when you can get over that, that self-talk, I don't know anybody who goes, whether it's going to the gym or says, oh, that was the worst, I can't believe I trained. It's always, well, you know what, I actually feel better for it. Almost 100% of the time. So let's go back into that low heart rate training, because this is something I've battled with. I've only really been running for 2 years. And it's only now that I've been able to let go of that ego part that always wants to beat the time. And for the very first time in 2 years, I've brought my heart rate down, but it's taken months and months and months. So stop chasing yourself. And honestly, the time of my run, it's not very different to when I've been hitting 180s and going into lactic acid. Whether I'm averaging a 145 heart rate, still finishing within a reasonable time, but the difference is you finish the run feeling like you can go again. That's the thing, and it's a completely different experience. And I don't think I could have ever done that earlier on in my life, in my 20s. I don't think I had the mental maturity to stop pushing or stop racing or competing. It's such a gear shift in your brain. How do you, in your experience as an athlete, how do you get people to understand that?
All right, so two things there that I want to pick up on, just off, slightly off the topic. You said a moment ago, that's something I would have never got right in my 20s. And I think for athletes in their 30s and their 40s, careers established, kids kind of can handle themselves, ego becomes less important. And so, you know, for someone maybe listening to this going, but I'm 40 and I didn't start to run in school, is it too late? The answer to that is definitely not. There's some runners that have amazing careers from 40 and into their 50s, some starting in their 60s, Deirdre Larkin starting in her 70s. So it's never too late. So the heart rate thing is probably the trickiest thing to get right. And what I've done, I wrote four articles on my blog on low heart rate training. I meet with my athletes every Monday night. We do a Zoom call all together, and I push low heart rate training. I send them an email once a week. This last week, sent them an email with a breakdown of Eliud Kipchoge, who is, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, the greatest runner alive right now, and his lead up to Berlin Marathon. And you kind of go, you know, if you're running at 3 minutes and actually sub 3 minutes per kilometer, all of your training is going to be through the roof. And yet at just about 70% of his training for Berlin Marathon 7 weeks before was low heart rate training. And so you've got to hit that nail with a hammer about 1,000 times, and then athletes suddenly get it. The other reality is that, so two things with that. The one is that, let's say an athlete running at 135 beats a minute, whatever that low heart rate is that we set for them. At first, they're going to be walking almost every hill, and sometimes even walking is going to take it above 135, and they end up standing. And trust me, I've done that as well. And that's fine.
So frustrating.
Just for this to drop down. And I know that these athletes want to kill me, and they send me WhatsApps going, I am going to kill you at some stage, and we've got to keep it lighthearted before I do lose my life. But Give it a few months later, and that same hill, they're slowly jogging up. Give it months later, because this is always a long-term thing that we're trying to achieve here. They're actually running up that hill.
And remember, it's endurance. This is not a short game.
Exactly. And then give them a few more months, and to maintain that low heart rate on a downhill, they are sitting there at like 3 minutes 30 a K, and they still can't get to that low heart rate. They're kind of going, I don't know how fast I have to run to get there. The other reality is that low heart rate's not all of it. We then throw in, but only when we've got the body adapted and tissue strong. And by tissues, I mean bone, tendon, ligament, and muscle. It's all of that that has to strengthen. When we get them strong later on, we throw in the fun stuff. So then the intervals and track and hill sessions and tempo runs. And that's how you then sharpen a person for race. So that's the thing there. And what I always say to people is that low heart rate is all about margin. So if you went to hire a car, and the salesman said, or the, you know, the car hire person said to you, this car goes at 120 k's an hour, but at 6,000 rpm, and it's got a max of 7,000 rpm. That car at 120 has got very, very little margin to go any faster. If the car hire person says to you, this car at 120 k's an hour has a revs at 3,000 rpm, but it's set at 6,000, it's got capacity. So that low heart rate runner then on race day, and they're very specific formulas that we use to calculate where they should generally be on heart rate, they've got margin. And so they can then speed up. So a runner running at 6 minutes a K on low heart rate on race day is suddenly running at 4:50, you know, obviously depending on, on the distance. But that's where that, you know, building margin and getting people to understand that.
And it's very much something that you integrate into your body. You know, the mind doesn't get it until the body gets it, which is quite fascinating. How accurate do you think these heart rate monitors are, the wrist-based ones?
So there are a couple of things there. There's some that are more accurate than others. There are a couple of things to a chest strap is always going to be more accurate. So the little heart rate monitors on your wrist have got little lights, and those lights light up the capillaries, and they watch for the expansion of arteries, and that's how they calculate that. So if they're slightly off the wrist, it's going to, they're going to vibrate, and you're going to get a very high heart rate. The heart rate strap that goes around your chest is like an ECG. It's picking up electrical signals. So that is really rare. That's the most accurate way to go. So for any serious runner, I would look at getting that. So the first things are that on the watch, make sure that the watch is quite tight. Make sure that it's just by that little bony bump on the outside of your wrist. So you don't want it sort of too high. I will, so I've got like a couple of little holes left here for the eyelet on my strap. But if I go and run, I'm going to tighten it by two.
So it doesn't shift.
So it really is kind of pressed there. The other big thing that heart rate training will teach you is it will teach you the importance of hydration, the importance of electrolytes, and really that's kind of your game where you come in there, is that if you're dehydrated or if your electrolytes are out of whack, your heart rate is going to be way, way higher. The more you dehydrate, the thicker your blood gets. Most of us walk around dehydrated.
Absolutely. Most on any given day, subclinically dehydrated.
And so I think that one of the benefits of low heart rate training is it brings you in tune a little bit more with your health. The other thing is looking at your heart rate in the morning. What happened overnight? If you wake up and your heart rate is 5 or 6 beats higher, you're either getting ill or you're really, really stressed. And again, this is learning and listening to your body. If you're really stressed and you've got like a 10K run and you wake up and you go, I can't do 10K, that's fine. Listen to your body. Just do a 4K run.
Yeah.
And do it slowly and speak to the lorries and look at the clouds and breathe the air and look at the flowers and the blossoms and bring that back. Not every day is going to be a hero day.
Yeah.
So, you know, things like hydration, things like stress, a stressful day at work, we need to understand that training is a stressor.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you've had a stressful day at work and now you're on a training program that says you've still got to do that this afternoon and it's freaking you out, that's too much stress for you. And somewhere along the line, you've got to create a little bit of balance again.
Mm.
So that's, I think heart rate training is more than just good training. It's understanding something about your body.
It's being in touch. I always say to people, if you train and you come back from that training session feeling energized, so you've got an energy return from your exercise, then you're fine. But if you're getting an energy depletion from your exercise, then you've got to sleep more.
Yes.
You've got to recover more.
Yeah.
And
you've got to get nutrition right.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
And going back to what you said about electrolytes and hydration, most people are magnesium deficient, and that is a primary electrolyte.
Yeah.
It's not the only reason we get cramps, but it's one of the reasons.
Yes.
It's also one of the reasons we don't sleep properly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think magnesium supplementation is very, very much overlooked.
Yeah.
And it directly feeds the heart muscle. So if your heart rate's too high, you've got to look at magnesium supplementation as
well. Yes, absolutely.
Mm.
And you've got to experiment with that. And that's your field. I mean, that's where I would then chat to somebody who knows what they're doing there and really try and get some guidelines. Your nutrition after a run. I know that I had you on my pod, and you know, I think one of the big things that came up from that talk was the importance of protein.
Absolutely.
So that your body can rebuild itself, recover properly.
So on the subject, let's chat about fat adaption and athletes, because I'm still very much on the fence of a keto adapted concept with it when it comes to serious athletes, at least, because I work with quite a lot of them, and although they follow very much a fat-fueled lifestyle when they are not racing. When they're racing, they still need those carbs. So no one really talks about that. So as an athlete yourself, what are your thoughts?
So where I'm at, and I know that this thing changes the whole time, is I think I tend to agree with Alex Hutchison. If you can get Alex Hutchison's book Endure, it really is one of the better books available right now. And Alex Hutchison makes the argument for training on slightly lower carb. It is critical for an endurance athlete that the body learns how to burn fat. And again, this is where low heart rate training comes in. If you head out the door into a sprint, it's just mitochondria, just ATP, and you've got 2 minutes of fight or flight in order to stay alive. And at the end of that, your body's going to feel a little bit heavier. And from then on, you're going to be in glycogen. And there you've only got a limited store. Whereas fat is the ultimate endurance fuel. Alex Hutchison points out, I think it's in his book, that, and I don't know why he uses, there was obviously a study done on the average man, that the average man with a slight tummy on him has got enough fat, if he could fat adapt, he's got enough fat to be able to exercise for 100 hours without any food.
Wow.
Now, none of us have quite got that right. Mm. So Alex Hutchison points out that you should train on lower carb, but I do believe that hardcore athletes do need carbs. I'm a big fan of Tim Noakes. I'm a big fan of everything that he's done, and I think your type 1, type 2 diabetics need to basically, for me, I would follow Tim Noakes.
Totally.
If he says jump, I would jump.
Mm.
I think for an athlete that is now beginning to add hours, I know that I need some kind of carb.
Mm.
I know that obviously the more complex carbs, the healthier. You don't want to go and put your carb in a juicing machine because you want to be able to chew the thing. You want to take it with fiber, with salads, because you don't just want to get this big
spark.
Insulin hit. Mm. All the good things that you can do health-wise. Mm. And then certainly when you are racing, you do need carbs.
I agree.
And so, you know, it looks like you need about 60 grams, but that differs. Some people on 60 grams are just going to be vomiting all over the place. And it seems as if the carbs or the glycogen is actually used more for the brain.
Yep.
And that the body goes, if you're going into low heart rate, the body goes into fat burning from almost the get-go.
Yeah. Yeah, I can completely relate to that. The trick that I found works really, really well is taking a date and putting some macadamia nut butter in there. So you've got your quick carb, yes, but you've got the fiber, and then you've got the fat bound to that, which slows down the response, but it gives you like a trickle charge,
yes,
of glycogen. And you can go for hours.
And you've got some protein.
And you've got a little bit of protein in there, which is, so everything balances off nicely.
Yeah.
And without going to the extreme of going to like syrupy goos, which are just glucose, which for a lot of people, it's a big problem.
Yeah.
Especially not, you know, you're the amateur athlete, like myself, for example. We expect from our bodies what we see, you know, expect what a professional athlete outputs. Yeah. We don't put in the rest and recovery, and I want to talk about that just now,
yeah,
or the fueling and the months and months of focused attention that comes from eating properly.
Yes.
We don't do that, but we expect the output that an athlete gets without, yes, doing the inputs.
Yes.
And it's very frustrating to, you know, you've got to do the work.
There are some gels on the market that have only got like sort of 4 grams worth of sugar in them. And so there are some that are quite well designed. But again, athletes have got to fiddle with that. I can take gels very successfully on a bike because they're very, very, you know, they're easy to open, easy to get in. On a run, it can spell the death of me, especially some of the gels with high sugar.
Yeah.
Because from there to getting nauseous is literally at like a 5 minute gap before I'm in trouble. So
absolutely. Well, the gravity feed is different when you're running compared to when,
yes,
you're cycling.
Yes, compared to when you're cycling.
So you've got to,
yeah,
think about, you know, the point from A to B,
yeah,
what it's doing to your stomach.
I like the idea of what you said there, because also with the food type you described now, you're also chewing. And so you are warning your stomach.
Yes.
You're telling that peristalsis to get going. You're telling it that there's a little bit of food coming. Also on the run, I found one of the big, big game changers for myself was making sure that I took enough salt in during the run.
Oh, for sure.
Because without that, all you need is for your stomach to close up because it's unhappy with the sort of wobbling motion of running. You've got a bit too much sugar in it.
Mm.
It's getting upset with you. It's closing, and all the water you're pouring down is not getting into your gut. It's just building up. And that's sort of that run where, you know, if you're running, you're feeling nauseous. I know this is going to sound a little bit gross in the next 30 seconds, but, you know, if you're feeling like that, get behind a bush, shove your fingers down the back of your throat, get rid of that water because it's just sitting, it's not going through. Get rid of that so that the nausea can go, and then whatever you do, don't have anything more to eat. You've got to start introducing water with tiny bits of salt so that you can begin to thin all of that down.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, no one really talks about that, but I think loading with salt and electrolytes 48 hours before a long run or 24 hours before, say, a 10K or a 21 is more valuable than, say, the classic carbo load method.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. It's more of an insurance policy that you're going to get through.
The carbo loading seems to only give people about a 15-minute benefit. So, you know, if you're able to run for an hour and 45, heavily carbo loaded, which is 3 days of just pasta and glycogen and insulin spikes and stuff like that, you're going to give yourself an hour and 45, you'll be able to run 2 hours. But you're going to get to the race start heavier than what you want it to be. Mm. And you've trained your body then just to always expect sugars to keep going.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've done the low heart rate training, we do kind of every Saturday, like a minimum of a 20K run. And that's just done on water without breakfast beforehand. And my body adapts. There's always a little thing in the back of my mind going, but what happens if you feel terrible? And so I run with a little bit of money on me. If I need to get to a petrol station and buy some sweets, I'll do that. But, you know, generally, or I'll put a goo in just in case something goes wrong and I've messed up something. Mm. This is where the body learns how to fat adapt.
Oh, for sure.
And that's an amazing place to be.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or the anti-aging effects of exercise, and even why not exercising, even just walking, is so much more beneficial than sitting still all day. What are your thoughts there?
So I think the thoughts are that we were made to move.
Mm.
And there's a statement, and I've forgotten who made it, but the statement goes as follows, that everything in medicine needs to be seen in the light of evolutionary biology. So in other words, you know, if you say, is sitting healthy for you? Question needs to be asked, were we doing a lot of sitting 500,000 years ago? Yes, we were. Did we have chairs? No, we weren't. We're squatting or we're sitting cross-legged on the floor. And so the, you know, were we drinking sugary juices 500 years ago? No, we weren't. We were finding berries. You know, if you got really lucky, you found a beehive, you'd get some honey into you. We were chewing on potatoes, but we hadn't invented fiber. So, you know, you chew on that potato for about 4 hours, lots of fiber. We were eating meat. You know, for me, everything that I look at in my life now, I kind of judge, is this good or bad for me? Would I have been doing that 500,000 years ago? Mm-hmm. And 500,000 years ago in evolutionary biology is a slither in time. It sounds like a lot, but it really is a slither in time. Even if you take us 110 years ago, let's say, before we had the automobile, before we had steam, and before we had electricity, we were all very, very active. So we weren't designed to be still. We weren't designed to sit for the hours that we do sit. We weren't designed to have the type of food that we have, highly processed food that hasn't got enough fiber in it. We weren't designed to even eat that regularly. I mean, we would have a big meal and then we'd go without food. So your hunter still, you know, in the Kalahari now is going to go on that morning run hunting for an animal on an empty stomach. And he's going to have to sit there and work out how much hydration he's got on board, how long he can run. He's going to run that animal into exhaustion and then kill the animal, because we're terrible hunters. Mm. I mean, we've got like really pathetic teeth. We've got these like dainty little nails. We just, you know, we're bad at killing.
Yeah.
So we had to run animals down, which is, and that's where we also developed the ability to sweat. And animals don't have that. So if you can get an animal to overheat by chasing after them, eventually you get them exhausted. So, you know, so I think evolutionary biology points us to the fact that we were runners. I'm a triathlete, but for me, I love being on the bike. I love swimming, but running is that primal place.
Mm.
You know what I mean? There's something that takes me back to the inner caveman, you know, which you don't get when you're in a gym, in a pool, or on a bicycle made out of carbon fiber with gears and wheels and stuff like that on roads. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is that my big thing is that we were designed to deal with stress. And we were designed to deal with high levels of stress. But we weren't designed to deal with stress that gets stretched over hours.
Yeah.
So stress for us 500,000 years ago was going through the bush, because you're also listening out, because as much as you were hunting the little bunny rabbit or the springbok, there was also someone trying to hunt you.
Yeah.
And so that whole thing was a stressful thing. Coming up against an animal that was attacking you, you either killed the animal in 2 minutes or the animal killed you. If the animal killed you, your stresses were over. If you managed to kill it in 2 minutes, the pure exhaustion of that fight of it's you or me, and then realizing this animal is valuable, there's meat, there's skin, there's warmth, there's bones, there's tools, there's everything in here, I've got to get the animal back.
Mm.
By the time you got that animal back, you were so exhausted that your 2 hour hunting trip that was stressful left you, you had burnt off all adrenaline, you would then get back to your clan, and you'd probably sleep that day whilst everybody would then turn this into skins and meat. And what we do now, and this is the tragedy of modern day living, is people get in front of an email and they open it up and there are 120 of them, of which 80 of them are high stress. We're cancelling this. We want this at a cheaper price. Mm-hmm. You know, your salesman sucks or whatever. And that entire day is stress. And I don't think we were designed for that. So we're designed for high stress, but over shorter periods. And I think that's where for health as a human being, you've got to get rid of some of that adrenaline. You've got to get your body moving again.
Mm.
You've got to clear your mind.
Mm.
I think one of the big things chemically is that there seem to be two major flows of chemicals, one at about the 30-minute mark, from endorphins and kephalins and cannabinoids. So you kind of get like almost a bit of morphine into the system, but it's without any side effects because it's bodily produced, and a little bit of cannabinoid, so also without any sort of there's a high, but you're not, there's no danger involved. And then it seems as at the hour mark that there's another big dump of chemicals, and that dump of chemicals, just that's what runners get addicted to,
the reward.
Yeah. Mm. And it's that moment also where blood tends to flow from the cerebral cortex and moves down to the motor cortex, because the body has got to move. So we need coordination. There's breathing, there's arm swinging, there's leg movement. And it's that cerebral cortex that is the kind of the worry part of our brain. That's the part of the brain that... And I'm not an expert on this, but the bit that I've studied is really focused on what do other people think about me? Classic example, 20 people can tell you you're looking great, and you need one person to go, gee, you're looking a bit tired today. And what happens at that moment? Mm-hmm. The 20 compliments, you can't remember a single one of them, and every time you get in front of a mirror, you're kind of going, What did he see? Where am I that bad? I mean, it is enough to destroy a person's day. And that's that part of the brain. Now, when blood trickles away from that, you forget what you look like, which is why runners often, at the end of a run, we do these track runs, and sometimes we take a photograph before, sometimes after, and you've got people that are sweaty, and they are bedraggled, and they've got these huge smiles, and you put it on social media, and none of them mind, because that you actually don't care what you look like when you run. Give that person an hour after that, and they're trying to get color-coded clothing on, trying to get their hair right, and they're obsessed with what they look like.
Yeah.
Other big thing with the cerebral cortex is that's the part of the brain that is forever trying to work out consequences. So you hear of an earthquake in Tajikistan, and suddenly your brain's going, but what happens if there's an earthquake there, and the ceiling fell on me, and I was trapped under it for 3 days, and I had to drink my own urine, and something that is probably never going to happen suddenly becomes a fear factor for us. It's that part of that brain. I think Tim Ferriss calls it the monkey brain.
Yes, it's the monkey brain.
Yeah, the monkey brain that just goes, this could go wrong today, that could go wrong today, this could go wrong. That part of the brain that is forever just going, this could go wrong, that could go wrong, that could go wrong. If that goes wrong, 3 other things could go wrong. And, that monkey brain is enough to drive anyone nuts.
And we believe it. We immerse ourselves in that state, and it's got nothing to do with reality.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And I think that when that dies down, I've got a run that I call my psychologist. And it's a 20K run. I've done it so often, I know every crack in the pavement. I know every house. I know where the cracks are in walls. And I make a decision. If I've got a big decision to make, I make the decision that I'm not going to think about that decision over the first hour. And so I get into the run, and those chemicals come in. And there's a very specific point where I know that I'm an hour in. I can point the corner out. It's, what is it? It's on South and Stigling. That's the hour mark for me. And from there, I got this quiet road. And there I sit there, whether it's a business decision or whatever it is. And I sit there and I go, right, where are we at? And I'm low heart rate. I'm not trying to beat last week's time. And there's a clarity there where I go, if I go there, and there's a quietness that comes there, and it's birthed in reality, versus what you said in a moment, like half the things we imagine, are so far removed from reality. And over the space of the next hour, the amount of decisions that I've made on that last hour with a clarity, I've spent a few weeks before with pros and cons lists, and I just find at that moment my brain is just so in tune with where I'm at. I'm quiet within myself, and I think that that's critical for us.
Yeah.
Critical for me.
Yeah, I think it's the antidote to the reality we're living in at the moment. And
yeah.
I completely agree with you that exercise is akin to psychology. You know, when
yes.
it for me definitely it's just put off making decisions or thinking about things too hard until we've done the exercise. And you do see things from a different perspective. But as you said, there's a real chemical reaction going on in your brain. And it does help you to pause between stimulus and response, which is, you know, the key to managing most things in life is to not just jump in with a response or a reaction that you're going to have to patch up afterwards.
Yes.
So it does help you do that.
Yeah.
Let's just nip back onto the shoe technology, because I think that's something that people are really interested in.
Yes.
It is a minefield out there. I know myself, I've made lots of bad decisions, and I have thousands of rands worth of shoes sitting that I can't really use because it seemed like a good idea at the time. So I think, you know, coming to you and understanding the difference I think some of my biggest injuries have been bad shoe decisions.
Yes.
So what is your pet peeve when it comes to making bad shoe choices?
My pet peeve would be the, and I understand where we come up with that misunderstanding, is the thought that the softer the shoe, so the more it feels like a cloud when you put it in a shop, the healthier the shoe is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality, the physics reality of that is the exact opposite. So what happens is when your foot strikes the ground, it's striking between 5 to 8 times body weight.
Wow.
The forces going through the foot, through the knee, through the hip, the entire kinetic chain, I mean through into the neck vertebra, all of those things are quite immense. The physics way of measuring that is called the ground reactive force. So there are ways of working out exactly the kind of level of shock that goes through as that foot strikes the ground. And the irony is, and this is one of those things, it's almost like low heart rate training you've got to kind of tell the brain, listen, I know you think you're right, but you're wrong on this one. The softer the shoe, the higher the ground reactive forces.
Really?
So what happens with a very soft shoe is that your feet have got millions of nerves in them, and the link between foot and brain is a very, very profound link, and they are constantly working out what's going on. Mm. When they touch ground and it is so soft, the brain gets quite lazy and it allows the body to actually hit harder.
I see.
And that is a mistake that a lot of people make. So I get a lot of people in and literally just look at the shoe, they pronate a little bit. Pronation, by the way, is the inward rolling of the foot. And pronation is a healthy response to a point. There is a pronation that becomes very counterproductive, and there we've got to get a shoe that actively works against that. But even a person that runs quite neutrally, that very soft shoe very, very often causes issues. And it's the exact same, you know, the best way of illustrating that is that if I got you on, we've all got quite weak feet now because we spend a lot of time in shoes, but if I got you on a flat tiled surface quite long and told you to run barefoot, you would, your brain, your feet would immediately tell your brain, I've got nothing cushioning me. And your brain would adjust quite radically the way that you land. And so it would get you landing with your foot far closer to your center of gravity, as opposed to that foot really swinging out. That sort of Johnny Walker pose. You know, I've always said Johnny Walker is an overstrider. Your running looks like Johnny Walker. You're doing yourself unbelievable levels of harm. Whereas if you're bringing that foot close to center of gravity, you're landing way more naturally. You're landing way more lightly. There's more speed in that. There's
less energy expenditure.
Less energy expenditure. Mm. That foot coming out there like Johnny Walker, I'll get a runner on a treadmill and I'll kind of freeze frame as that heel strikes the ground, and it's striking the ground way, way ahead of their hip. And I'll say to them, can you see that heel position in the ground there? And they'll go, yep, I can see that. And I'm going, do you know that there's only one sport where we start with the heel in the ground like that? And they kind of look at me and they go, what is that? And I go, it's tug of war. And with that, you see the smile because they realize, hang on, tug of war, I'm trying to go backwards.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And here I'm running and I'm hitting the ground so hard there.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so now if I get that ground closer to my center of gravity, and there's a little bit of a forward lean, suddenly we don't get these braking mechanisms, which can bring about things like plantar fasciitis, patellofemoral pain syndrome, knee issues, lower back issues, etc. So I think it would be the incorrect choice of shoes, and the person that looks at me and says, but I was in the shop, put my feet in these shoes, and I just sunk into the ground.
It feels so good.
And they were so soft, and I'm going, let's talk about your injuries.
Yeah, yeah. That's not what you want when you're running. Look, I've tried both extremes. I've tried, you know, but truly on the other end of the spectrum, those very minimalist shoes aren't, I mean, I've run in five fingers.
Yes.
You know, you can't get more minimalist than that. So what are your thoughts also on the minimalist shoes?
So on the minimalist shoe side, you know, the book came out, Born to Run, and that kind of caused the minimalist shoe revolution, which came and went. And you know what the author did is he, you know, he writes about these Tarahumara Indians in South America, and they're running vast distances every day. But they're running on beaches, they're running up and down trails, they're running through mud, they're running through forests with leaves on the ground. They've obviously got very tough feet so that they don't get splinters and things like that. But I really believe, take those runners featured in the book and dump them off here in Sandton on hard cement, and it's not going to take that long before they're injured. The other reality is, remember that those people are really living a very, very primal lifestyle, whereas we're quite soft. I mean, we're doing this podcast sitting on comfy chairs, and I drove here, and you know what I mean, we are way softer. And so I think that the truth lies somewhere in between. You know, the five finger for most people is going to be too harsh a shoe. The incredibly soft shoe is going to be for most people too soft a shoe, and the truth is somewhere in between there. The shoe needs to do a little bit of work for you. You know, if you're going on holiday and you're at the beach and you want to run barefoot, go for it. You know, obviously make sure your skin is tough enough so that the sand doesn't, you know, wipe five layers of skin away. But you know, if your shoe, you know, I mean, you're going to have a beautiful run there. And if you find a soft forest and your feet are, I don't know, you know, splinter-proof run through that forest floor, it's going to be beautiful. But for most of us, it's just impractical. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think coming to somebody like you and getting proper advice, you know, looking, for me, it was quite an eye-opener seeing how I strike that surface on a camera.
Yes.
It's not what I thought at all, I mean, really. And what those shoes were and weren't doing, and I really believed I'd bought these hugely expensive, fancy shoes that were going to solve a problem. And they didn't. They actually made the problem worse.
Yeah.
You know, with the best advice from somebody at a shop, like you say. So I think getting that right is key to the comfort and sustainability of any sport.
Yeah.
It's really, it's not always buying the fancy latest technology. It's what's right for your body.
Yeah.
You know, at the time.
And then as well, realizing that the shoe is part of the equation. The other part of the equation is strengthening and stretching. And again, with stretching, most of us don't understand stretching. And the reason why is that, you know, someone will give you a pamphlet of the 20 stretches runners are meant to do. You don't need to stretch a muscle that's already stretched. You only stretch tight parts. And this is where people have got to understand their bodies. My right-hand side quad needs way less stretching than my left-hand side quad. It's always tighter. Why is it tighter? I'm left-handed. Maybe I'm more dominant there. I'm not 100% sure, and it doesn't really matter. All I know is that I've got to spend more time stretching here. Most people have got hip issues. Our hips are too weak. And that includes people, by the way, that train a lot. A triathlete, everything that they do with their hips, whether it's swimming, it's the legs are moving forward and back. They get onto the bike. The legs have got a slightly different gait, but they're still moving forward and back. And then on the run, it's a slightly different order of things, but still moving forward and back. And they never take side steps like a squash player does. And so there's no lateral stability. So the best thing that, in my mind, that you can do as a runner is get into the right shoes, work out where you're tight. A lot of us forget about hip flexors because kind of go, but like, where are the hip flexors? You know, it's something that you hear about and you don't realize that there are actually four main hip flexors, and we can find them and we can palpate them and we can massage them and we can stretch them. The fact that the two of us are seated right now means that our hip flexors are in a shortened position. Mm-hmm. And I've got track later on. I'm going to be doing mountain climbers. I'm going to get movement through my hip flexors, so that's fine. But for a lot of people are listening to this podcast seated and maybe going to drive home, and then they're going to sit in front of a TV set and kind of go, I don't know why everyone tells me my hip flexors are tight. Mm. And you can get by with tight hip flexors when you're younger. Mm. But, suddenly when you're in your 50s, when you're in your 60s, when you're in your 70s, those hip flexors can cause huge amounts of trouble.
Pain. So, yeah, that was something I also found really interesting after consulting with you, was that the pain isn't necessarily injury. It's often weakness.
Yes.
And strengthening the counter ligaments and counter muscles to that problem, even doing planks,
Yeah.
really goes a long way to getting rid of the pain.
Yes.
And not always to think, oh, I'm injured, I've got to take time out. So you need to strengthen a lot of the things you never realized that yeah. were, you never. But also, what I found was, I thought, how on earth could I have a weak glute? I've been doing gym my whole life. So, you haven't been doing the right strengthening.
Yeah.
Simply doing a leg press isn't necessarily making that muscle stronger.
The other reality is that there are three glutes, and I kind of wish they had different names, because the moment you say strengthen your glutes, everybody thinks of the Kardashian family, and the part of the glute that you're sitting on might be incredibly strong, but it's glute medius and glute minimus, which are on the sides,
Yes.
Nobody kind of
exactly.
Remembers them, and those are the guys that are going to pack up the quickest, and you're going to have nothing to show for strengthening them.
Yes.
If you do a Kardashian workout, you're going to fill jeans, but nobody ever walks around going, have you seen my glute medius? So it's let's get the right glute stronger. That's the critical part.
Yeah, there's so much more to it. Like we said earlier, if you're going to expect your body to give you outputs and you want to train like an athlete, you need the information, the coaching, that you provide.
Yeah.
To get this output, you can't just grab a pair of shoes and off we go and expect to do a 2-hour marathon. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And really, it takes a lot of time and effort to get these things right.
Yeah.
So, Mike, where can people get hold of you? Anybody listening to this who goes, I need this help. Where can we reach you?
So our website is sbrsport.me or .co.za. The shop's number is 066-236-9187, so people can always give us a call, or better, get on the website, the sbrsport.me website. It will give you an idea of what we do, so that you kind of get a little bit of a better idea. Mm. We're on Facebook as SBR Sport. I'm on
Instagram
as Mike Roscoe _SBRSport. Mm. So people can get an idea of what we do there.
Yeah. And you put out lots of tips and really interesting information all the time on Instagram and IGTV.
Yeah.
That I found really helpful. Just to keep remembering, that this whole thing is connected right from your head to your toes on an internal and external level.
Yeah.
You've got to consider the whole body.
It's endless.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's an endless learning curve.
Yes, it never stops. And you've got your own podcast coming out really soon, which I can't wait to listen to.
Yeah.
Some very interesting guests.
Absolutely, of which you're one of them.
It
was one of the coolest interviews.
Good.
I actually can't wait to listen to it.
Yes.
Because I need to learn again from that. Yeah.
So thank you so much again for your time. I'm really hoping, that renews for a lot of people listening their enthusiasm to get out there and move, because it's so important for your brain and body.
Yeah.
I think it's really a big part of an antidote to the life we live mostly.
Yeah. No, thank you.
Thanks
for having me on.
Thank you. This episode of the Reinvent Health podcast supports Free to Run SA, a community-based South African initiative to make recreational running and walking safer for everyone. By partnering with a number of private security companies throughout the country, Free to Run is on a mission to create awareness and keep all South Africans safer in their neighborhoods. Visit Free to Run SA on Facebook to find out how you too can create a safer suburb.